Okay? It takes a lot to insult me. Some people have tried. So, because I think, look, one of the things that gets lost in certain things, a point I want to make, and I'll read a couple things, and try to give you an idea, and what is a, I think a lot of you can have a hard time with it. I'm not trying to use that as an excuse. I think basically people have been enormously dumbed down in a kind of hostile way where we've reached the point, and I think this is some of what was Adorno expresses, we've reached a point where we created a situation where people get annoyed at having to think about something. They think everything should be prepackaged. You know, it's the argument you get to be in politics, right? Well, can't you get it down to a simple sentence that the man in the street can understand? Can't you make it, you know, I need something that I can package for my friends because, you know, they run the, you know, why do people feel so confident in being stupid? Because all of your friends are stupid. Okay? And so you feel confident going back to the stupidity. Say, well, I can be stupid here. I don't have to listen to anything. Because I know that my friends listen to hip-hop. My friends have all this stuff. My friends believe in multiculture. You know, it's sort of, everybody has, there's two levels of it. Well, everybody's got their own victimhood. So they say, well, I've been victimized by this, I've been victimized by that. And then I got my group that's been victimized, and we're fighting for what we want. And then some people figure that's even too much for me to think about. Mainly, I got to go out and fight for myself. I'm the world's leading victim. Okay? And frankly, what you find is this is part of the way people, this is your conceptual apparatus. And you get very annoyed at the idea of having to think about something. You find this oppressive. That's the essence of the authoritarian personality. That's what the Frankfurt School, that's the specific form of fascism that you're dealing with. The irony of fascism, and it's relevant to discuss for the as an introductory point, the irony of fascism is fascism did not come about through the simple introduction of a dictatorship. Fascism came about through the demoralization of a population. From the idea that there is no basis upon which the citizenry of a given nation can come to agreement, can discern what the truth is, and formulate a policy based on that truth. That therefore, we are required to accede to something that says there is no truth. There is nothing you can discover, and therefore you simply have to follow what I do because I'm going to impose order on you. And you need order. You need safety. You need security. I'm going to defend your identity against everybody else. And since we can't have a process whereby we come to discover anything. For example, give you an example. Who is one of the biggest destroyers of science in the 20th century? One of the most anti-scientific people you could imagine. Adolf Hitler. Hated scientists. Wanted them herded off in various places to maybe produce a weapon now and then. The Nazis hated science. They hated the idea that human beings, because, see, if you have a scientific society, then you have to train your population to a certain level. You have to train them to deal with the technology. You don't use slave labor in an advanced scientific economy because they can't function with the level of technology. So the idea is dumb people down. And so, for example, you had one of the elements of the buildup of some of the anti-Semitic elements was Jewish science. Einstein, many of the other leading German scientists, many of whom fought in World War I, many of whom created the armaments industry or contributed to it, like Hahn and others, Haber and so forth, one of the leading chemists. These guys were all Jewish. Many of them were Jewish. But in the 1920s, the Nazi Party attacked Jewish science. It was incomprehensible. It was oddball. It was hard to understand. We have to have a native science. So what you find is the authoritarian personality or authoritarianism or the reaction to authoritarianism as you've been taught it is the reaction to the idea that there are truths in the universe to which you have to submit your ego. And the Frankfurt School says, hell with it. Why? Why bother? Can't you simply assert yourself? Existentialism. Now, lest anyone thinks, people will say, oh no, we got this. No, you know, frankly, most people don't know what the epistemological standpoint is that presently runs society. Now, I'll give you an example. I'm going to quote one thing, and hopefully give you an idea how this goes back. A long struggle. I'll give you an example from American history. But in a recent document, I'm just going to quote one point. In the ancient Athens, after the work of Socrates and Plato, ordinary shackles were discredited, although never abandoned as political instruments of government. The Romans, who experienced some difficulties in managing their acquired Greek and other slaves, were assisted in dealing with the difficulty by their rediscovery of what had become generally the lost works of Aristotle. The Roman conquerors put Aristotle's advice to work for them in their combat against the superior culture of defeated classical Greece and against any Christianity but the captive pantheonic version of their own choice of making. And then it goes on to the use of Ptolemy, the replacement of Aristarchus by Ptolemy's outlook, and so on and so forth. That this was spread again later in contrast to the Renaissance in the 15th century. Later, English, Dutch, and French empiricism were superseded by a still more radically degenerate system, a system known by the alternate name of logical positivism, or the radical empiricism of Bertrand Russell, and such among his postmodernist intellectual offspring as Norbert Wiener and Johann von Neumann. The method of them all, from the Eleatics to the followers of the Eleatics, through Aristotle and beyond, has been the following. The method of putting dehumanizing shackles on the human mind, as expressed by all of these systems, is the method of formal ontological reductionism, which I have described summarily as the systematic architecture of an induced fishbowl mentality. That is the form of the shackles of the mind which the thus self-enslaved great majority of the people of the USA have continued to put upon themselves, especially during these most recent four decades. Such is the culture and fate of those who have chosen to be human cattle. The epistemologist's study of the way in which Aristotle's method of enslaving the mind was employed as a new disguise for achieving the intention of the then discredited method of the sophists. This is the most crucial of the studies which must be conducted in the effort to free the members of European civilization from the system of brainwashing which rules and ruins the world today. Now, let me give you an idea. Johann von Neumann, some of you may or may not know. Von Neumann is one of the founders of modern economic game theory. This is the idea that essentially there is no truth, there are no values. That basically what the economy is a balancing off of the pleasures and pains of various people in the worldwide market. That's the only way that value is ascribed to things. What people want has value. What they want to avoid doesn't have value. And then there's a game theory approach to how the economy works. This is not different than Adam Smith, who says, don't try to order anything in the economy. Human beings are simply driven by their pleasures and pains. You shouldn't try to do anything else. And let the great director of the universe, to whom you may pray, or you may feed things to on an altar. You may ask the goddesses and the priests to come to your aid. You might play the lotto. But don't try to figure out what to do. You're too small, you're too insignificant, and you don't want to give up your own personal pleasures and avoidance of pain. So irrationality, statistical models of how people will react to certain things, are the economy. Now let me give you a sense of Johann von Neumann. Now the relevance of this is that in the period, we can be very explicit, in the period after the war, World War II, when you had basically the beginning of what we have in Children of Satan 3, which is political as hell. It is politics. Epistemology is politics. Philosophy. Most people are run by philosophies and epistemology, and then they run around saying, I don't want to hear all this complicated bullshit. You're run by that complicated bullshit. In fact, the less you want to hear of it, the more you're run by it. Okay, now, to give you a sense of what happened after World War II, there were two elements of this. You've heard a great deal said about what was done. Because after World War II, during World War II, there was a cartel typified the case that's often mentioned as IG Farben and Standard Oil and so on and so forth. There were others. There was a cartel. A lot of the banking was done in Switzerland, which was really the cartel that financed fascism throughout Europe. Because fascism was throughout Europe, not Germany. Germany was one fascist and the most significant military power on the continent. Although in part, that's only because France was so screwed up, they couldn't even use the military power that they had. They were so rotted from the inside that even though on a one-for-one basis, the French military was the equal of the German military, it collapsed in 3 weeks because they had no idea what to do. Now, this cartel was largely run by people like Goering, people like François Janoux, Hjalmar Schacht, the people who created fascist economics. So when the Nazis were defeated on the continent, you had people in the United States typified not just by names like Dulles, but what was the Dulles family? They were Wall Street lawyers for the banking cartels, for the Morgan family. And they remained such throughout the entire middle third of the 20th century. Now these people brought, through largely the financing of these remaining financial networks, fascist organizations into NATO, into the United States, and they also funneled this anti-authoritarian. Why? Because they were afraid of what? What was the anti-authoritarianism? Was it against Hitler? Hitler was gone. Prussianism doesn't run North America. It's ridiculous. They were brought in against Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the American system. They were brought in to make sure that the policies and the initiatives already initiated to succeed in World War II would not be continued. FDR was the authoritarian that they attacked. That's why you have, any one of you, that's why you have today, you'll go out and they'll tell you, FDR manipulated World War II. He directed the Japanese to bomb Pearl Harbor. He was a wealthy Wall Street lawyer with communist sympathies, who was run by his wife, who was really pink. Okay? And you hear this from every populist nutcase around, and it goes into the regular schooling because these people won't take it on because it would be authoritarian to say that's wrong. So you had this come in. Now the element of this that paralleled the Frankfurt School, which these people were explicit fascists. Okay, if you read Leo Strauss is a fascist. He says explicitly, there is no truth, and you have to define an enemy to keep a nation together. And some in existentialist terms that sometimes, you know, get people all excited, you have to define the other. And people get mystified. What's the other? This is a new metaphysical concept, the other. That's the other than yourself. And other than the people that you like. And that's the person that you try to kill. Now, you had this coming out of the Frankfurt School, Carl Schmitt, everything that you said, one of the things that kills me today, a lot of what people hear, particularly some of the newer people, say they don't like the Iraq War, torture in Abu Ghraib, bad things, right? But then you say, well, look, this came in. Let me show you how this came in. Carl Schmitt wrote the law. Leo Strauss educated people about this outlook. John Ashcroft is a student of this. Many of the people who wrote the legal opinions were students of this. Oh, yeah, well, you can't, you know, but geez, you know, you can't really say that. Are you saying there's a conspiracy? Well, it's not really a conspiracy. If you change the way people think, you don't have to do much conspiring. You can do it right under their nose. And you say, well, you know, you can't do anything about it because you're just, you don't have the power to think about the ideas that would change it. Go home and listen to your music, which we created for you, so you could call it yours. The stories I liked is, the one I like is how much, you know, the hip-hop business, Harley's a bit of an expert on this, but the one I like is how much the hip-hop business is run by people who are ex-Israeli intelligence. Yeah, the head of one of the main groups is a guy named, funny name, Lyor Cohen, L-Y-O-R Cohen. He's a 6'5", blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy who is Air Force intelligence in Israel. Okay? You know, the stuff that we show, you know, you guys, you go to a rave. Who runs the ecstasy business internationally? The Israelis. Okay? And you sit there, you say, well, it's my drugs. I mean, I don't know how stupid you can be. I mean, I'm sorry, you know. You think there's anything that Wall Street investment houses like better than watching people run around in the street with their head plugged into the most pounding, debilitating noise you can possibly imagine, unable to think, and they say, "Well, gee, that's we like that. We'll finance that. You can have your little rebellion." Right? That's express yourself. Now, the other element of this it was very strong coming out of World War II was explicitly the view that human beings cannot conceptualize universal principles. Now, I'm going to refer to this in a certain way, the way it was historically a little bit, but because there's a traditional debate on this. Which is, what is an idea? An idea, any idea worth its salt, is an idea about the universe. Any application of the mind is an effort to organize the universe along principles that allow you to act on the universe. So you talk about humanity. Or you talk about, I'll give a good example of this that's practical politically. You talk about the Union of the United States. What's a nation state? A nation state is a universal principle. It's an idea which the citizenry of the population applies to itself and its relations to other nations for all of the relevant universe. The relationship among societies. The relationships amongst people. If you reduce the human mind's ability to conceptualize a universal principle to a series of experiences, to simply a set of experiences over time, and you say there is no such thing as a universal principle, the human individual mistakenly thinks that a series of similar experiences can be grouped together as simply the custom and habit of their experience. So there's no idea, there's just the habit that we have. For example, we take a country. The country has X number of people, in X number of ethnic groups, in X number of races, and so on and so forth. And really what is a country is some agreement amongst all these different people to accommodate their experiences to some kind of self-defense mechanism. That there's no principle that binds them together as human beings. This question came up last night. There are some differences, but fundamentally, the idea of a republic is there is no difference amongst human beings. Now, there's a perfectly good principle. And people say, all men are created equal. And people, now you get the people these days, well, why does it say men? Why does it say men and women? Because by men, they meant everybody, folks. Okay? That's why it wasn't necessary. They knew that. They didn't think men applied to the male of the species. They said men applies to everybody. It's short for human. Okay? I mean, you had this explicit debate. This is what Lincoln said. Because you had a bunch of these the slave owners who said, well, no, men only applies to property-owning white males. That was their view of it. See, in a funny sense, think about this. The people who say that you have to say women agree with the slave owners. Why? Because the slave owner says men doesn't apply to everybody. It's not a universal principle. And they say, well, you have to correct it to say women. It's the same view. Lincoln's view was all men are created equal. The operative term is all. And it applies to everybody. It applies to the human species. That was his argument. People get very confused when they read Lincoln because you get a lot of propaganda against the guy. As I said, my favorite one, many people heard, is he was a slave owner. That one, when I heard that one, I said, boy, that's great. They're so off the deep end. Nobody in Lincoln's neighborhood owned a slave. Okay, it didn't happen. He really was poor, for one thing. Later on, he became a moderately well-off lawyer. When being a lawyer was not a terrible profession. Okay? His wife's family owned slaves. Now, how that gets to be Lincoln-owned slaves is a piece of insanity. Now, what was Lincoln's argument? Lincoln's argument was the principle of the Declaration of Independence applies to all human beings, even if you don't think in certain ways they appear to be equal. And this is where people then misinterpret them. I said, I don't know if everybody can do exactly the same thing. There may be differences amongst individuals. There may be differences that you can tell me about in groups of people. But in the quality of being human, all human beings are created equal. That is, every human being has the power to grasp an idea. And Lincoln pretty much says it this way. And therefore, they are all equal. That's a universal principle. On the right-wing side, you'll get people who say, well, wait a minute, you know, I can prove differences in IQ scores, et cetera, et cetera. On the left-wing side, and this is where it comes, on the left-wing side, you go, well, no, you have to respect all the differences. People have different pleasures. They get to do everything. They have to be able to pick what they want to do. And the right-wingers say, well, fine, we agree. People are not equal. And so let's have a competitive race, and those people who come out on the bottom, they're not equal. And if it so happens more of them are people of color, well, you know, we're not racist. We're just, that's the way it is. Sure, we didn't give everybody an equal start, but we couldn't do that. It would cost too much money. And everybody agrees it would cost too much money. We don't want to pay for big government. And so you get this kind of ridiculous stuff. Now, after World War II, a whole series of people are brought in from pretty much the same environs as the Frankfurt School who argue that there is no such thing as a universal principle. That's a principle that's discoverable about the universe by the human mind. Everything that we do is, in fact, a statistical generalization which we then apply as some logical formal system within which we have to reside, like the economy. You know, one of the things I think people have to ask themselves when they appeal to public opinion or this isn't accepted. Remember, the Iraq War was public opinion. You know, it's all well and good to blame it on George Bush and Dick Cheney and so on and so forth, but it's a little bit of a cop-out. Popular opinion accepted the war. In fact, I've seen most people, as soon as you say Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, they stumble, even the people who oppose the war, they stumble, they mutter. They don't know what to say because everybody agrees Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. You don't go to war against every bad guy in the world. That would be a lot of wars. Now, it's true, Cheney and Bush do plan a lot of wars. Okay? But if you, that's popular opinion, or the passivity of popular opinion. Now, it's a, when you think about what, now much of the present, what do we mean when we say the system is going to fall? Well, we mean the system is going to fall. That is, the way people think and act is collapsing. It's stupid. It, in effect, it rules out the human mind. So it's very hard to be smart when you exist in a system that denies the validity of thinking. When you're just supposed to be stupid. And just accept it. Accept yourself the way you are. I have a hard time thinking about complicated things. That's how do people react to science most of the time? It's difficult. Why are you bringing this up in a political situation? Why don't we just talk politics? Things that people understand. Because science runs what we can do politically. You want to solve a problem, you have to have the science and technology to do it. You want to solve the problems in the Middle East, you have to have a water program. A water program means nuclear energy, desalinization, et cetera, et cetera. You can't do it stupidly. Stupid is Sharon. You build a wall. That's security. You got to think about how much people, the propaganda depends upon stupidity. We got terrorists running around. We got to stop them. You got to give up all your rights. You got to shut the country down. Well, wait a minute. I have another. No other ideas count. You don't know how bad it is. Could be any second. Shut the elections down. Then somebody was smart enough to say, well, gee, most terrorist incidents don't cover the whole country. Okay? I guess if we computerize the election, we might have a problem. Anyway, so I want to give you a sense. Von Neumann is exactly, and what happened after World War II is that LaRouche, who was, came out of the war, was kind of a Roosevelt, not really a Roosevelt man. He appreciated what Roosevelt had done, that the country had pulled itself out. And there was an idea that we had the power to liberate the colonial world. And a lot of people will be cynical about this stuff. In fact, there was a liberation movement. It was rough, it was unfair in many respects, but there was a certain direction upward. If you look at things like lifespans in Africa today, in places like Zambia, Zimbabwe, South Africa, there's a bit of a dispute about, but fundamentally you had by the 1980 period, lifespans in much of sub-Saharan Africa that were not that far from the advanced sector. In other words, you were getting lifespans that had gone up from the mid-40s to 60, 63 years. It's a good measure. Lifespans in most of sub-Saharan Africa have dropped by 10 to 15 years. In some places, like Zambia, lifespans have gone from the upper 50s to 38. Now, it's AIDS, but it's more than AIDS. And even the AIDS issue proves the point. Because this devolved in Africa as the African economies went into collapse under the IMF debt system. So what came out of World War II, what Lin represented, and he saw that what he saw was the introduction of systems, formal systems of the way in which you view human beings and the way in which you therefore acted in economies that were destructive, that were going to destroy the economy that had been built up under Roosevelt, the scientific capabilities and so forth. Now let me give you a sense of what this system looks like, and then I'm going to give you something that might be a little surprising. This is Johann von Neumann, Actually, it might be the 1930s, but a lot of these guys came over after the war, or during the war. The leading idea of Hilbert's theory of proof is that even if the statements of classical mathematics should turn out to be false as to content, nevertheless, classical mathematics involves an internally closed procedure, which operates according to fixed rules known to all mathematicians, and which consists basically in constructing successively certain combinations of primitive symbols which are considered correct or proved. This construction procedure, moreover, is finitary and directly constructive. It means it can be done in a finite number of steps. In other words, although the content of classical mathematics sentences cannot always be finitely verified, the formal way in which we arrive at the sentence can be. Consequently, if we wish to prove the validity of classical mathematics, which is possible in principle only by reducing it to the a priori valid finitistic systems, then we should investigate not statements, but methods of proof. We must regard classical mathematics as a combinatorial game played with primitive symbols, and we must determine in a finitary, combinatorial way which combinations of primitive symbols in their construction lead to methods of proof. Now, if you really think about that, it's a much sharper statement than you probably consider, because you want to focus on funny words that you're not used to hearing. But he's saying, basically, classical mathematics is not true about anything. It's an internally closed formal system. It's a game. And we apply that because we can find certain generalities which we can formulate as axioms, and we apply then the system to that. Now, I'll just give you one other element of this, I think. To be able to indicate the direction which a proof of consistency takes, we must consider formal proof procedure. Certain formulas characterized in an unambiguous and finitary way are called axioms. Every axiom is considered proved. If A and B are two meaning formulas, and if A implies B, and we know that we accept A, then B has also been proved. Now, fundamentally, that's all you need for one of these formal systems. A set of axioms and what they call modus ponens. If A, then B, and if A, then B. Okay? Now, that's the essence of a computer, by the way, a binary system and a formal logical software program, which may get fairly complicated because you give it a whole bunch of different paths to take and because you can electronically speed up the mechanism. And the real essence of the computer is the hardware, not the software. The software is stupid. Okay? Now, what we mean, let me put it to you this way. What we mean by the system collapsing is this. This doesn't work. If you try to run a real-world economy on the principles of game theory and formal systems, which is what von Neumann is. This is not an exaggeration. Von Neumann and Morgenstern wrote the textbook, which is the basic text of modern free market theory. It's called The Theory of Games by Morgenstern and von Neumann. Okay? Now, these guys operated out of Princeton, where they ran something of a Gestapo on top of it. Now, I want to give you something funny on this, because probably the world's earliest known formalist of this type, and I'm not going to go through this, but the first written philosophical thinker who argued, number one, the human mind cannot generate universal principles, that we are finite, we're what he called a featherless biped. That's Aristotle's definition of man, okay? Although some people today have feathers, so I don't know how that would count. But I don't know, I thought it was funny. But anyway, and developed certain form of the first formal logical systems, though a lot of them had problems in them. Aristotle. When we say Aristotle, look, you have to understand who Aristotle is. Aristotle was Plato's enemy. He was not a student of Plato. He was brought in to oppose Plato on this question of the ability of the human mind through a Socratic dialogue to come to certain conceptions of universal truths that are at least the basis for further development. Now let me give you something funny from, because it has a funny part to it, from the Nicomachean Ethics, which, by the way, is where Aristotle defends slavery and so on and so forth. As some of you may know, Plato's Republic, other things, where Plato, for Plato, the idea of justice is a universal principle. It's something that you can discuss and improve. Justice is actually a certain kind of virtue, where the ability to distinguish generalities from truths, from ideas, is in a sense the discussion of everything he does in the dialogues. People get a somewhat funny version of this, which is Aristotle's version, i.e. Plato thought that there were these forms up in the sky and you could, you know, they were eternal and changeless and so on and so forth, and then somehow you would compare them to something in your experience and you would get an idea, you know, this is a horse, this is a chair. That's not Plato. Plato argues against that in the Parmenides, for example. For Plato, an idea is a universe, is a hypothesis about the action of a species, the types of action that characterize certain phenomena, the capabilities. And there's if you like, a hierarchy of ideas leading to the principle of the good, which, as he says, is the concept of becoming, the concept of continuous perfection. Or another way to put it, I think more appropriate to Plato, is the continuous improvement or the continuous lack of imperfection. The continuous reduction of the imperfections in our knowledge of the universe. Now, I want to read you something from Aristotle on justice. Now, admittedly, the way he does this is not exactly his concept of justice. It's his concept of distributive justice, because for Aristotle, basically, there's just different kinds of trying to make things come into balance. Okay? So there's no real concept of justice, but let me give you this. This has to do with distributive justice. The judge restores equality, as though there were a line divided into two equal parts. He takes away the amount by which the larger part is greater than half the line and adds it to the smaller. Only when the whole has been divided into two equal parts can a man say that he has what is properly his, when he has taken an equal part. The equal is median between the greater and the smaller according to arithmetical proportion. This is the reason why the just has its name, dikaion. Maybe somebody can pronounce it better for me. It is a division into two equal parts. For when X amount is subtracted from one of the two equals and added to the other will be larger by 2X. And so on. He goes in this vein. He just talks about balancing this off. Accordingly, we can use this procedure to ascertain both what we must subtract from the party that is too much and what we must add to the party that is too little. We must add to the party that is too little the amount by which the median is larger and subtract from the greatest the amount by which the median is smaller. And then he goes on to a description. The terms loss and gain we have been using come from voluntary exchange. To possess more than what was one's own previously is called making a gain. And to have less than one started out with is called incurring a loss. Now, this is admittedly a translation, but you'll see the interesting element of it. In buying, selling, and all other transactions in which the law permits the agent freedom of action. But when neither party has more or less, but exactly what they contributed to the transaction, they say that they have their own without loss and without gain. In the same way, the just and involuntary transaction occupies the median between a gain and a loss. It is to have an equal amount both before and after the transaction. Now, to start with, Aristotle's just talking about zero-sum game theory. That justice is a zero-sum game, where, in the one hand, the losses balance the gains, and hopefully they get to be fairly equally distributed. Now, of course, nothing about justice, for example, in terms of bringing justice to somebody, is involved in this. There's no sense of an improvement or a development. It's just a redistribution of goods. Now, as you get this, it also begins to sound even more. Now, remember, Aristotle was about early 4th century B.C. I think he lived from something like 384 to 324 B.C., somewhere in that. Okay, so we're talking about roughly 2,400 years ago, 2,300 years ago. Now compare that to our friend von Neumann, game theory, formal systems. Now, then he talks about reciprocity. But in associations which are based on mutual exchange, the just in this sense constitutes the bond that holds the association together. That is, reciprocity in terms of a proportion and not in terms of exact equality in return. For it is the reciprocal return of what is proportional that holds the state together. Now we jump to the state. Reciprocal, in other words, there are gains and losses, but there's a certain sense of a back and forth, a zero-sum game. People seek either to requite evil with evil, for otherwise their relation is regarded as that of slaves. Now, this is basically a somewhat not too sophisticated version of an eye for an eye. Or good with good, for otherwise there is no mutual contribution. And it is by their mutual contribution that men are held together. That is right. That is the reason why the state erects a sanctuary of the graces in a prominent place in order to promote reciprocal exchange. For that is the proper province of gratitude. We should return our services to one who has done us a favor, and at another time take the initiative in terms of doing him a favor. Reciprocal exchange, and then he goes through proportions like a builder, a shoemaker, a house. So this is all economics. It's essentially economic theory in this form. But if there is no proportionality, the exchange is not equal and fair. The association of the two will not hold together. For there is nothing to prevent the product of the one from being greater than that of the other. And they must therefore be equalized. Let's say the shoemaker and the house builder. This is true of the other arts as well. They would disappear if there were not a relationship between an active and passive element, such that one performs and the other undergoes precisely the same thing of the same quantity and same quality. For a community is not formed by two physicians, but a physician and a farmer. They must have some exchange principle. It is for this purpose that money has been introduced. It becomes, as it were, a middle term. Now, apparently the Greek can also be currency or money. For it measures all things, not only their equality, but also the amount by which they exceed or fall short of one another. Thus, it tells us how many shoes are equal to a house, or to a given quantity of food. The relationship between builder and shoemaker must therefore correspond to the relationship between a given amount of shoes and a house or a quantity of food. For if it does not, there will be no exchange and no community. And the relation will not be the same unless the goods are somehow equal. Consequently, all goods must be measured by some single standard, as stated earlier, and that standard is in fact need, which holds everything together in a community. For if men were to require nothing, or not to require things equally, there would be no exchange, or not the same kind of exchange. Now, money has by general agreement come to represent need. That is why it has the name currency. It exists by current convention, and not by nature, and it is in our power to change it or invalidate. In other words, I would argue that Aristotle is the first monetarist, or at least the first one that I know of. This is the idea that monetary theory controls the formal system of economic exchange. And there's no principle of development. There's no principle which governs the growth of the state. There's nothing here about the development of the citizenry, the role of the citizenry in the functioning of the state. There is no universal principle other than the formal system itself. Now that's 2,300 years ago. And that's Johann von Neumann. It's modern free trade economic theory. It's really what runs your life. Even if you find, well, why do I have to go back on this way? Then I have to figure this out. This is reality. This is Aristotle's conception versus Plato's Republic. It's the conception, in many ways, that the Civil War was fought over. The Civil War was fought over the introduction of British free trade as the dominant economic policy of either the entire nation or at least the southern and western portions. In other words, the idea was to introduce slavery into the South and into the West, and if necessary, give up the North. That was secession. A lot of crazy people in the North wanted to give up the South and say, well, let's free ourselves of slavery. But the problem was you'd have slavery in the great portion of the continental United States. Lincoln, now what was it? Lincoln said there is a principle of the Union. There's a universal principle which binds this nation together, without which we have nothing. And that's what the Civil War was fought over. Not simply slavery, but the principle by which you could overcome slavery, which was the American system of political economy, which is what Lincoln introduced. And there was legions of things written on this that probably none of you either know or could even find. Henry Carey on the British slave system. A lot of Lincoln has been lost on this. It's there, but people don't read it. That is, once you take the ability of the human individual to formulate a universal principle, to embed it in a sense, in a concept of what the truth is, you've lost. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Now, one of the reasons we identify Bertrand Russell as the most evil man of the 20th century is because of this. In other words, what did Russell do? All these guys based themselves on Russell. Von Neumann was a collaborator of Russell. Morgenstern was a collaborator of Russell. Now, I'll make a point that's of some interest for people to look at. Russell, in the early part of the 20th century, with a guy named Whitehead, who I don't think he played that significant a role in it, produced something called Principia Mathematica. Now, there's a reason it was called Principia Mathematica, because it was a follow-up of Newton's Principia. Newton's mechanical principles, the reduction of universal principles to simple mechanical summations, simple algebraic formulas. One of the great frauds of history, although some of it wasn't done by Newton. I mean, Newton himself was a bit of a, he was a bit of a charlatan, and he may have had some facility, but he was promoted by a group of people who opposed, in particular, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Because what you find is there's nothing that Newton discovered. The principle of gravity exists in Kepler, who's another one of these guys who's been slandered to a large extent. The calculus was discovered by people like Leibniz, the Bernoulli brothers, and so on and so forth. All of this is documentable, although it's controversial. And because one of the lines from the British is, like you get from all the stuff, is that Leibniz plagiarized the calculus. Now, of course, it's not easy. They had to come up with a big construct on this, because, to give you an example of how complicated it gets, Leibniz did the calculus before Newton. So the problem is, how did he plagiarize something that came after him? Not an easy problem to deal with, but they did deal with it, because they discovered that there was a guy named Barrows who actually set the basis for the calculus before Newton, and he was before Leibniz, or about contemporary with Leibniz. And Leibniz got a hold of Barrows' notes, lecture notes and so forth, and that's how Leibniz jumped the gun. And then Barrows had gotten his work from things that he had discussed with Newton. So in effect, plagiarizing from Barrows was plagiarizing from Newton. And that, my friends, is the story of how Leibniz stole the calculus. Except, if you look at this, by the way, if you just look at the notation, there's no similarity. And Leibniz's notation is uniquely superior. And nobody uses Newton's notation. If you saw Newton's calculus, you wouldn't recognize it, even if you had taken a calculus course. It doesn't really work, at least as a usable system. Okay? So, Russell calls his great magnum opus Principia Mathematica, and this basically is Russell's claim to fame. I mean, one of the reasons he's viewed as one of the great geniuses of the 20th century is because of this. And actually, it's one of the reasons why the 20th century is such a mess. Because at its inception, I mean, the 20th century was characterized by a pessimism about humanity. by giving up the idea of progressive discovery of universal principles. And part of it was embodied in the idea that the human mind itself cannot generate universal principles, cannot communicate universal principles. So what does Russell argue? Russell argues that you can reduce all of classical mathematics to arithmetic, and all of arithmetic to a formal system, to a logical system. Basically, it's something, the name isn't that important. I mean, it's a little more complicated. It's essentially what I read to you from von Neumann, except you can express somewhat more complicated sentences in it because the formalism. Basically, what it is you can express what they call universal expressions and existential expressions. For all human beings, if you're human, you have two legs, unless you were injured or something. There exists a human being that has such and such a quality. And then there are certain formal rules for the manipulation of these symbols. Now, what's a universal, what they call a universal modifier? It has nothing to do with the universe. Okay? It means that everything that you plug into the equation has to be taken into account. There's no idea involved. It's a generalization. It's more than a generalization. In fact, a universal is simply a list of what you think is in the universe, one by one. And in principle, the idea is to check each and every one of these things to see if it's got that characteristic. Now, but what you can do is you can manipulate these symbols to come up with certain theorems that are necessarily true within that formalism. And so he says, this is all of mathematics. Now, and this is what we mean, by the way, this is the assertion that has to be done by finitistic methods. Now, this gets to be an interesting problem for people because, well, what would it be to have infinite methods? We can't do anything infinitely. So it would take a lot of time. So the argument is that everything has to be done in a finite number of steps. And everything has to do by one of these formal procedures, which, of course, any calculating device could do. There's no thinking involved in this. Now, to make a somewhat longer story short, and these are things that are worth looking into, not so much for the value of it conceptually. Much of the 20th century is a desert conceptually, but rather because you get an idea of how these things work. You take what people's belief in digital computer systems, or the idea that human beings and animals are the same thing. And this is where it comes from. Yes, there were discussions of this before, but in the 20th century, and in particular after World War II, out of an increasing pessimism about human capabilities, this has become the self-conception. It's why people would argue, if I want something this way, no one can argue with me because there's no principle of truth. I don't exist in a universe that's governed by any principles. I exist out of my own feelings, and I have to accede to a system because the system has more power than I do, and I have to live within the system. Now, this has become increasingly the outlook of the baby boomer generation. Now, what happened with Russell? And this is, Russell is an incredible cynic, an incredible person to read. Science is bad because he had an argument with H.G. Wells, which I thought was interesting. These were two promoters of Fabian imperialism. Wells himself was one of the leading members of this liberal imperial outlook. Okay, which was, well, you have to give people certain things, but we have to rule them. Okay, now Wells's view was you had to have a little bit of science, because why? Well, it's a simple point. Largely from a military standpoint, you had to have a scientific capability to keep up with perhaps competing powers so that you wouldn't find yourself at a major military disadvantage. And now you're going to get to see what we're talking about with this Russell version of liberal imperialism. Russell's argument, because in a certain sense he was a nastier person even than Wells was, a really nasty person. If you read, for example, and this is a little ad hominem, but it's interesting, you know, if you read his children, they hated his guts. He was a son of a bitch. I mean, he was the kind of guy who taught his kid to swim by throwing him in the ocean and said, swim. And I think it was his son or his daughter who nearly drowned. And, you know, let's say he didn't have the greatest relationship with him. Okay? He was a nasty. Now, what was his view? And you get, that's it. But you get a sense of his nastiness from this. His view is no. Wells is wrong. Because whatever science you have, and this is something important because people have a very bad idea of science. Too many science fiction films and so on and so forth. Science is evil. It brought us the atomic bomb and all this kind of stuff. So what's his view? You can't have any science. So therefore, your objective is to destroy all scientific research wherever it might be. Why? Because even a little bit of science is dangerous. Because you never know that it might slip out. And people might get the idea that progress in human conditions is possible, that human beings can learn ideas they never knew before, and that sense of individual purpose and individual identity is dangerous to the existing powers. Therefore, there should be no science. Now, even the British didn't go along with this, partly because they didn't control enough. But part of the idea of the post-World War II period, and this is what Lynn refers to. So again, this is eminently political. Part of the idea was, this is this idea that sometimes confuses people. The idea was, use the threat of nuclear war, even the example of nuclear war, to get people to give science up. Give up anything that might lead to a weapon. Give up science. Now, if you want to know the truth, obviously, in some sense or other, right, this is what was behind the so-called justification for the Iraq War. They had science. And they shouldn't have any. I mean, what the hell is a dual-use technology? I mean, a fork is a dual-use technology. You can eat with it, you can poke somebody's eye out with it. I mean, you know. Probably as many people have been killed in domestic incidences with forks as, you know, a lot of military weapons. I tell you, you know, if you get into a domestic dispute, I would worry a lot less about the radium in your watch and a lot more about the knife in the drawer. So the basic idea is you take away from people any sense of scientific progress. Any sense that... Now, I'll make one point, which is a larger point, and I don't want to... I mean, look, everything that you do involves, in some form or other, the generation of a universal or a hypothesis about the world. There's no such thing as pure sensory experience, even on drugs. I mean, a lot of you sometimes think you've reduced yourself to the essence, the door to the universe, because you're on a drug, and it's a pure sensory experience. There's no such thing as a pure sensory experience. In every case, in a sense, from the very beginning, you're operating from certain principles of the complex domain, in the sense that everything that you experience is organized by certain principles. Some of these you begin to get by the socialization that you get as a child, and the family, the parents, etc., organize your access to the world for you. And really the first principles that you learn are social principles. And those social principles begin to organize your experience of the world. And embedded in them are certain principles about how you act and the kinds of responses you'll get from adults. And this develops in a complicated way into a conception of how the world works. What are the principles by which the world works? If the family exists in a fairly traditional or a feudal society of some kind or other, you really begin to think that the world works through the powers of some mysterious sources. The power of the baron, the power of the monarch, the power of some other traditional form of society that runs things, and you actually think that if you propitiate these powers, it's a form of principle, then that's the only way to get control over the world. As human beings develop scientific capabilities, you begin to learn that your control over the world is through knowledge of the physical principles of the universe. And you can never separate this out from the communication of those principles. That's why, for example, and people, you know, you can't go in to a poor neighborhood and simply drop in a physics laboratory and say, you're going to become, this is what we're doing for you. You're going to become a scientist. Why? Because you're dealing with maybe a kid at the age of 10 or 12 who's had no experience of that idea that universal principles discovered by human beings are effective in the world. He has no sense of control over the objects around him. So he's going to look at this laboratory like it's, you know, try to find out which part of the laboratory to propitiate, to say something to that might make it work. You have to actually grow up. It's like this thing that people were talking about in terms of finally reaching certain capabilities. If you want to know why Mozart, even though there may have been something obviously special about Mozart, he was also operating in a situation where music was a language of thought from the time he was an infant. Where the family thought in musical terms, where he had instruments at his disposal, where composition was being discussed while he was there. And it was discussed from the standpoint of developing universal ideas. It's a different culture. And no matter how much we talk about it, yes, that's something to strive for. I'm not saying you have to look at everything and say, oh God, it's all awful. You get this kind of pessimism. But you have to recognize right now the culture stinks. Most of what passes for education is pathetic. You don't know any history. You don't know the history of science. You're given one of these textbooks that looks like a web page with lookup charts on the side. And half the stuff you get off the web is insane. They take, like this thing that they read from Poe, they take things out, but now they do it all the time. If you put something on the internet, you just take out what you feel like taking out. Or you put something in that you feel like putting in. And since there's no idea that there could be any truth outside of the internet, that's based on discovering a principle about how the world works, you say, well, I have to accept this. I'm an underling. So you've had the 20th century. Now, the truth of this, and I'll make a couple other points later, but the truth of this is, of course, it's been known, really it's been known since Plato, that no formal system can replicate the generation of creative ideas by the human mind. And it even applies to something as simple as arithmetic. That is, the effort that Russell made to reduce arithmetic to a formal system failed. And I think this is a very interesting point. It failed. In 1930-31, a young guy by the name of Gödel, and it's interesting because he proved, and Gödel's a funny guy, but he proved that Russell's Principia Mathematica, that's what his theorem was about, actually. Russell's Principia Mathematica failed to formalize arithmetic. That is to say, what he proved is that Russell's system is either incomplete in the sense that there are truths in classical arithmetic that could never be discovered by Russell's formal system. There will always be truths that are not formally provable, number one. But you can know that they're true. Interesting point. He also proved that. Or, if the system is complete, it's inconsistent, which means it proves everything. So, of course, it'll be pretty complete at that point. Except the problem is you can't distinguish true from false statements. But you know you've got all the true ones. Okay? Now, in essence, this is what the Parmenides, this is what Plato demonstrates in the Parmenides, in that case against the Eleatics. But this is, people are impressed by it because it's a formal proof and so on and so forth. Now, what's interesting to me, remember, von Neumann is writing in the 1930s and 40s. This is after Gödel's proof. In fact, von Neumann knew Gödel. He knew Gödel at Princeton. He actually knew Gödel when Gödel was still over in Europe. And they had some interesting clashes, as he did with Norbert Wiener, Mr. Cybernetics. Okay? Now, what happened? And this is where really where Lynn came in a very profound way, in this particular history. And in this sense, see, I think people think of it. Look, Lynn is in this case, you can demonstrate it. In many ways, I can demonstrate, well, I don't care what popular opinion says, that Lynn is the most significant philosophical thinker by far of the post-World War II era. He virtually stands as the only competent representative of the Platonic tradition which demonstrates the falsehood of systems analysis, formal approaches, artificial intelligence theories, and so on and so forth. And represents, therefore, probably, I think, and this is what I'll get to at the end of this, the only basis upon which we are going to make scientific and political progress. Therefore, one can be completely optimistic that that scientific and political progress is possible. But you have to understand that it is, in fact, a political fight of the first order. You won't get progress by just going looking for scientific progress. It'll be destroyed. One good example of this is, look, most of you are, whether you want to admit it or not, because people get confused on this point. They think, well, I'm religious. I have faith of some kind or other, and that makes me different. I don't believe man is an animal. Well, the problem for any simple faith belief is that's all it is. It's just faith. You can't prove it. You can't communicate it to somebody who doesn't have the same faith. That's the problem with all this, you know, I found Jesus. Good, I'm glad you found him. I'm not sure who you found, but, you know, let's assume for the moment it's an accurate report. I took Jesus in me. Sometimes I think you took the devil and you thought he was Jesus, but, you know. Well, of course, you see people say, I took Jesus into my soul. And then they go and kill somebody. And they say, well, you know, say, well, wait a minute, you sure it was? Who was that? But you say, so, or you have this kind of, or you have people who say, well, look, no, I have my own personal feelings. That is not computerizable. That's not a machine. Well, it is a machine. It's just your own funny little machine that kind of bleeps out feelings periodically. It's sort of like your transponder. It just says, I'm me. It's, you know, and it's a signal to everybody else. Let you do your peculiar thing. There's no thought in it. This is where people get confused about human identity. Where is human identity? Now, one of the things that was done, which I always say with, is really what people like von Neumann do. It's what Adam Smith did. It's what Aristotle does. Is they say, okay, look, Gödel, okay, he proved this thing. It kind of upsets me because it was formal systems. I could tolerate it when it was Plato, but this is unnerves me a little bit. But you know what he's really proved? And this is just given as an argument. And there's a complicated way it's presented. But what it amounts to is the following. I'll reference a somewhat more complicated way, but what it says is, okay, Gödel has proved that formal systems cannot prove all the truths. That may be true, but that's a limitation on human beings, because human beings are limited to formal systems. Therefore, I can replicate, this is a perfectly circular argument, therefore I can replicate human beings in a formal system, in a machine. Because that's all there is. Now, they somewhat argue this, that obfuscates the issue somewhat by saying, well, all we can really know for certain are those things that are formally decidable, that is, are decidable by formal procedures. You may say there's other truths, but you can't prove them. Because the only way you can prove something is by a formal decision procedure. And then there's all kinds of stuff about decision procedures, halting mechanisms, and it gets very complicated and somewhat dazzles people. But that's all it amounts to. And there's different kinds of arguments which amount to the following. Every version of a formal procedure that I can come up with converges on the same method. Therefore, since all formal procedures turn out to be identical, we can say that we're limited to that. And that's artificial intelligence in the post-World War II era. That's the man as a machine, or man as an animal. Now, of course, the problem is this. We do have a proof. But it's not a formal proof. The proof is the history of human ideas in extending man's power over the universe, as reflected in the growth of the human population and its control over the universe. What are we doing? And this is what Plato's idea of a universal principle, universal ideas. The only ideas are universal. You organize the universe based on certain principles. Everything else you experience derives from that. So, how do we do this? What's human identity? This is where this thing gets. People always try to come back to what it is, people want what our friend Judge Scalia calls finality. Isn't there some point where we've got the whole thing? Where that's it. You got the whole picture. It's perfection. Everybody wants to know, well, how come everything isn't perfect if human beings can think? If there's some important power that human beings have. The fact of the matter is, human existence has no finality. There is no perfect zone. There is no paradise in that sense. Paradise, as Dante, a lot of people here like Dante, as Dante expressed it, was the discovery of the powers of the human mind. Was the discovery of how much our powers of creative thinking give us power over the universe. In a sense, then, the human mind generates not just universal principles, but how does it generate it? It generates it by generating an intention to act on the universe. It's not just some kind of mechanism. You intend to do something to change the course of what appears in front of you. And that's how you come to know what the universe is like. It's by creating points of interaction with the universe that are meant to change the direction of the universe that you act upon. Therefore, your intention has to be coherent, at least as an approximation, of the intentions that created the universe that we live in. And that's, like this question came up about what it is. That's all there is to being human. And people don't like it. There is nothing else about you that's uniquely human. Not the way you look, not the label, not anything. That's the essence of classical when we talk about why classical music. Or classical art, because it expresses that quality in humanity. It is what it is to be human. If you run around like a chimpanzee, you're not human. Now, you can do things that a chimpanzee does, although they generally do it better. You can act like a chimpanzee, but that doesn't make you human. You can imitate a chimpanzee, but chimpanzees can imitate chimpanzees. And I tell you something, since there seems to be a certain level of controversy about this, I would invite anybody here to go to a zoo where they've got an active cage of chimpanzees. Now, it is obviously a neurotic state to be in. You know, chimpanzees aren't meant to live in cages and so on and so forth. So periodically, I had the experience once about 5 years ago, some people might have been with us, we went to the Los Angeles Zoo. This was about April of 2000, I think, or maybe it was 2001. We went to the, some people, I don't know if anybody's here who stole it. Danny was there, I think, but he may have missed this. I don't know. Anyway, we went to the chimpanzee cage, and they went nuts. I don't know what was going on. They went absolutely nuts. And they were running around, pounding on the wall, rocking back and forth, you know, lips curled, screaming at each other. I won't go into the other things that chimpanzees have rather disgusting habits in many respects. Okay? And then you have people who do the same thing and call it entertainment. And defend it. In fact, there's a funny story, which is a true story. I've told it before, so people... I won't tell the horror story, but the funny story is, and maybe this is part of it too, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's rough places in the world, I admit. But they were doing a study of a group of chimpanzees in the wild. Of course, it wasn't that. There was all kinds of problems in this. But anyway, this is this crazy lady, Goodall. So she's down at the Gombe River Preserve. And, you know, there's always these battles for primacy. You know, one male, and males live very difficult lives. Most people don't appreciate it. That's why they don't live that long. They spent, in most species, it's the males who die first, you know, because they have all these massive hormonal surges where they try to dominate the harem or the clan or whatever it is, right? And the troop, I think they call them chimpanzee troops, I'm not sure. So you always have, over a period of time, some male rises to primacy. And even, you know, primates are a little different, but even there, they don't usually last for too long. And it is a certain combination of cleverness and strength. At any rate, there was one of these males who was really very unsuccessful. He was trying to be the primary male for quite a while. A little on the small side, really not all that aggressive. And all of a sudden, and this, he finds these empty gasoline cans where the animal observers were. And he starts to run through the forest, pounding these gasoline cans, swinging them, bouncing them, throwing, and they make this awful cacophony. And all the other chimpanzees are completely freaked out, including the dominant male. And thus, this guy, I think they named him Michael, you know, rose to the top and became the dominant male. Okay, so this may be some, there may be some moral in this story for musical performances of some kind or other. People, you know, you have to face it. That's sort of what it is. I mean, you take some guy who takes an electric guitar and just goes boing on it for 15 minutes and then breaks it over his knee, and you're supposed to pay for the replacement, apparently. All right? So, now, the fact of the matter is, what it is to be human. And this is the authoritarianism, the thing that you can't escape, is this is what it is to be human. You can say, I'm a human being doing all kinds of crazy things, but it really doesn't make you any different than anything else, anything in the animal world. To be human, you have to be different. You have to have a totally different characteristic. Now, how damaging is all this in the 20th century? Let me give you an idea of some of this. And I think one thing I think we need to look at now. This is something we need to discuss further. But if you look at some of the work, some of which we touched on here, and some of it we didn't. But if you look at some of what we have in the work on Gauss and Riemann, some of the stuff that came up in the discussion of the Moon model, Weber, the development of electromagnetism, and so on and so forth, all the things without which we couldn't exist at this point. I think if we look at these things in the right way, we have the basis for thinking that we could generate, both amongst ourselves and people who work with us, and others in the scientific community, the effort to solve some of the great problems of science that have remained for the better part of the 20th century. And they're there. Look, one thing, I was talking to Danny, because, you know, I don't think we should get too defensive about these scientists and all their great capabilities. Yes, they have access to computers and laboratories, although much of what they do these days really stinks. In fact, a lot of the laboratories have been taken down and replaced by computer modeling, which doesn't do much. Okay, now, for example, just take some idea. Look, and we have these kinds of problems. I'll start with things we can do, and then I'll go to some of the science is full of unsolved problems. The idea that somehow, again, that we've come to this completed point. We have the system in science. We have the formalisms. We have the principles, the laws. And now all we got to do is keep applying them. And there will be, you know, if problems come up, we just have to keep applying the same model over and over and over again. Squeeze everything into the system. And if it doesn't fit, well, just wait. And that's the idea that you have today. Now, it'll give you a certain sense of things, as was pointed out. And I think you have to also look at how limited we've been. I've discussed this before, so I'll go through this a little quicker. But look, as was alluded to by Oyad, we were on the moon, or Lynn references, we were on the moon in 1969 to 1972. Now, those of you who read this crazy stuff, we were on the moon, okay? All right? I mean, forget the theory that we were in a movie studio in Arizona or something like that. Okay? We went to the moon. We can't go there today. We had a plan to go to Mars by 1984. Now we're talking about God knows when. Now, what's the relevance of this? Well, begin to think about what we're looking at in terms of Mars or the issue that was raised with Saturn. We have a problem on the planet, which is how to, not so much transmute, I think, but how to develop resources, how to create the powers that we need to turn certain parts of the crust of the Earth into resources. Materials that we're running out of, or new materials. How do we do that? What's the physical chemistry of the elements as they're available to us on the planet? Now, here's the problem. There may be geological processes and chemical processes that come out of that that we are unaware of. However, if we go to places in the solar system where the same basic material has been used to form objects in the solar system, which reflect different chemical physical processes, we may then learn how to apply that and understand at a deeper level what the physical chemistry of the elements themselves are. So, for example, one of the things they discovered about Saturn, which is an interesting problem. Saturn is the windiest planet in the solar system. Now, it's not obvious why that should be the case. For example, one might think that Jupiter would be windier. It's the biggest gaseous planet that we have. Or why does Saturn, for example, have the most moons? What kind of formations are these? Where do they come from? What kind of physical processes go on? There are other anomalies in Saturn. For example, the magnetic pole and the actual pole of the rotation of the planet are about the same. That's not usual for most of the planets in the solar system. And so on and so forth. There are all kinds of things to find out that may, in fact, expand our power over the universe. It may mean changing and developing some of the laws of chemical formation of the elements as we discussed yesterday, and so on and so forth. Or take the case of fusion, which we really are not at the point where it's a technological question. But there are questions about nuclear formations, because the problem that you have, and I think this is something to be looked at, the problem that you have is we know that it's happened in nature, how do you get two nuclei to fuse in such a fashion that the amount of effort that you take to do that is substantially less than the output? And how do you overcome the barriers to that? Now, this may require, for example, in terms of the conception of the moon model, the introduction of some non-Euclidean structures. Because most of what we're working with so far is Euclidean, or exists within a Euclidean model. The question is, at what point do certain things come out of the geometry as you put it together, which generate geometries which allow for fusion to occur? Now, this doesn't mean it's not a matter of work, but it means you can control the amount of work. Now, there are a whole other series of things I think we have to look at in terms of the Gauss-Riemann work. For example, you have the question of quantum theory or quantum mechanics. This is one of the reasons that Lynn references people like Planck and Einstein as having represented the kind of creative minds that fought for a principle despite the opposition of everybody. Whatever, and I think Einstein is a guy to be looked at. He had political problems. On the other hand, his science is of some interest in terms of some of the breakthroughs, but also how he made the breakthroughs. You know, Einstein was not a mathematician. He hired mathematicians. He was a physicist. He was looking at physical principles. It's an interesting thing that when people think of Einstein, they think of some mathematical genius sitting down. He wasn't. He had certain ideas about the way the universe had to work, and he certainly had mathematical capabilities, but he ultimately literally hired mathematicians like Minkowski and Grassmann to do his mathematics for him, or at least to work with him on it. And this led to certain problems. Einstein did have a conception of a Riemannian geometry, but it was a limited conception. Einstein and Planck were really the people who generated the problems and proposed certain solutions that generated quantum theory. The photoelectric effect was Einstein, and then, of course, the hypothesis of a quantum of action was Planck. Now, what's interesting is both of them rejected quantum theory, not because they didn't think the calculations didn't work, which is what always comes up, but because there was no scientific principle of causality, nothing that gave us actual power over the processes other than to watch them statistically. And from Einstein's standpoint, from Planck's standpoint, that was a problem that science had to solve. And Einstein never gave that up. Both of them were basically viewed as kind of dodos at the end of their life. Fools, old fools who had made a contribution but were stuck. But of course, quantum mechanics has an enormous number of problems in it. Things that we don't understand, we don't know how to really control, and it really remains something of a block to solving some of the problems. Because we're not looking for underlying... They say, the argument is that even if you have more variables, you can't solve the problems. Yeah, but it's not a question of variables. It's a question of new principles. So these are things that I think if we approach them from the standpoint of our conception, the conception that's been developed by Lynn and Bruce and Jonathan and some of the people who are working on it, our conception of the topological nature of a Riemannian anti-Euclidean geometry, you can begin to think about, at least, that this is a direction as we draw other people into these kinds of thinking with certain experimental capabilities that we can solve it. Or take molecular biology. Another thing that's largely a block. You got a formal system, you can do a certain amount of manipulation, but you don't know what the nature of living processes are. You don't know what are the different physical characteristics, as Vernadsky would refer to it. What's the different characteristic physical action that occurs in life that occurs nowhere else? You've had a reduction of it to a formal system. Now you begin to get an idea of what it means. The system has failed. All of this is one systematic outlook that derives from a reduction of universal principles to statistical empirical generalities and rules out after the fact to a large extent. In other words, you make a discovery, then you get a mathematical handle on it, and now the idea is, no, there was never a discovery. That's not a principle, it's just a mathematical formula that lets you do certain things. Or take, for example, the anomalies in science are off the charts, really. A good example, I can refer you back to, if those of you want to look it up, of February or March, they had an issue of Scientific American, which was kind of a summary of modern cosmology. Now, it was funny, because it starts off with how modern cosmology has basically now discovered everything. Cosmic background radiation, I think they call it microwave, anyway. The cosmic background microwave, et cetera, and they've got the exact degree in this and that, and it was all very predictive. And fine. Then you read the second article, and you find out that the model includes all kinds of things that simply make the predictions work, but they have no idea. For example, 70%, some people say, there's different figures on this, 70% of the universe is dark energy. Now, dark energy is a contradiction in terms. I mean, dark matter was bad enough, because dark matter, you could sort of argue it was so cold that it didn't give off anything. But dark energy is something that's radiating something that you can't measure. And it's simply an artificial construct. It's simply there to make the equations work. Now the question is, can we address those kinds of problems? Can we at least begin to think in terms of what we would need to do? Now what we need to do is fight a philosophical political battle. We've got to be able to say, no, this system doesn't work. It doesn't work in economic theory. It doesn't work about human beings. It dehumanizes people. It takes their minds away. It turns them into animals, which is the intent. Put us in a zoo. You know, everybody has their own cage. Ethnic cages, racial cages, sexual cages, a kaleidoscope of cages that are supposed to identify you as things, professions. You get this kind of, you know, barracuda mentality on Wall Street. Well, you know, yes, we ate four people today. That's our job. Ken Lay, his argument is everything I did was reasonable because that's the way the system works. And you recognize that every element of the system has failed. And that's really where we are. What you have is what Lynn did. By taking on this fight, and this goes to what Lynn's economics is like. It's another long story I'm not going to start now. But what Lynn said is, no, if you take human creativity out of what it is, of human society, that's fascism. The system will necessarily fail. It's irrational. It doesn't describe human history. And that is what he fought. He began to fight and became the leading philosophical figure. And like people like Leibniz or Kepler or some of the other people we've seen, you know, particularly in a phase of collapse, he becomes slandered. What else do you expect? If you stand up for somebody like this, you're going to be slandered. And the idea really of slander, usually, is not to break the person's slandered. Sometimes that happens. You know, that's why Einstein didn't break, at least on the scientific matters. Gödel had problems. Planck did not break. You know, in some ways, I think Cantor did break. Lynn didn't break. What happens is you expect the people around these people to break. You expect other people to be afraid to be in the vicinity of a slander. Not much, doesn't bespeak one's courage all that much. You don't want to be near someone who is slandered. You don't want to find out because maybe it's not good on your job resume. So what we have is that Lynn represents the most significant thinker in this, and you know, some people, I find it relatively simple. In one sense, I don't know if Lynn would like it, but Leibniz was the greatest thinker in the Platonic tradition of the 17th century. In one sense, because he stood on the shoulders of Kuza and Plato and this and that and the other thing. You know, Lynn is the greatest philosophical thinker to date on these matters, because he stands in the tradition that he identifies. He encompasses, as applied to human economic practice, which is in itself somewhat unique, because this is, we're at a different point in human history. He encompasses the entire tradition of scientific discovery, of classical artistic forms, of that tradition in Western civilization in particular, Greek civilization, the civilization of the Renaissance, the Platonic tradition, the great breakthroughs of the scientific work of the 18th and 19th centuries. Much of that has been destroyed. Therefore, in fact, there's little progress in fundamental science, which is why so many people despair of things like curing cancer and so on and so forth. Now we, therefore, given the opportunity of the nature of the present crisis, represent the ability to carry this tradition forward. But only if we identify it for what it is. And we identify, in the case of Lynn, the person who reflects and carries that tradition forward. Then a youth movement becomes the ability now to create, we call it a renaissance, to create something entirely new, to solve problems that face humanity that aren't even being addressed. And that's the source of optimism. Really, optimism is the ability to face a question. It's not some kind of willy-nilly idea that if we're just happy enough, we'll solve every problem. You know, if I just smile at the problem, it'll solve itself. That doesn't work that way. So I'll end there. So we've got about 15 minutes of questions. Oh. See, a lot of people took my advice and went and took a nap, so that's all right. At least not too many of you took it here, anyway. Go ahead. Well, I think there's a lot more work to be done on it. I don't know all the answers. There's different ways these things are talked about, for example. I mean, don't forget, Ampère had an idea that there was what he called an element of electrical flow, really. So it wasn't so simply Newtonian. And he was trying to get an idea. Really, what was interesting about Ampère was that he was trying to get an idea of the geometry of these electrical flows, whatever they were. They didn't really know exactly what they were. Yet sometimes you have to really look back. For example, they didn't know about electrons in 1820. They didn't have a picture, an atomic model, even of anything like what we were doing now. These are things that you can't see. So he was looking for principles. So when he talks about what we know to be a flow of electrons today of some kind or other, and again, there are many questions about this. But at that point, he was just looking for some negatively charged element that was flowing, that was moving, that was creating, because it was the motion of these things that seemed to be creating attraction, repulsion, magnetic action, and so on and so forth. So now he wanted to look at, well, what changes occur in these flows as I do certain things to them? And I'll make a point about the experimental question, which is interesting. Okay? Now, What he in particular looked at that they didn't like was that there was a geometry to the flow. That is to say, that you had to take into account, as we've seen in other cases, the angular relationships between the electronic flows. That there was something in the rotation of the charge that affected the nature of the flow and the nature of the magnetic action. That's really what he was looking at. A lot of these words that get to describe it, was he reducing it to elements or not, is not so clear. He's just using a certain kind of language to get a hold of some process, some physical process he knew was going on. And his real hypothesis was, if we think of these things as flows of small elements, okay, what in the orientation of these flows is of significance? And what basically the Newtonians didn't like was the idea, as in many of these cases, that there was an action, a change in the geometry of the field, which would take the form in a formula of a relationship to the angular orientations. Now, what they try then to do is reduce it to a trigonometric function, which you can do as a calculation. But the interesting point is, why would there be an effect of the rotation of the orientation? What kind of effect is that? What's the nature of the relationship between in the actions of these things? Now, see, one thing is interesting. The point that they made yesterday when we were having a problem with the experiment, and of course we're dealing with limited capability, so you're going to do relatively primitive experiments. Okay. Now, but then you look at somebody like Ampère, who spends a great deal of time making a very precise experiment. Now, to make a precise experiment, you often have to refine your measuring capabilities, your production capabilities. You're going to have to get measurements that are accurate to a smaller degree of tolerance. You begin to use, you may have to shape your material a certain way. You may have somebody try to find a material that can be shaped that way. You have to have something that measures the electrical current. You have to be able to take Gauss and his little thing that he used to measure over distances, you know, where he would have this reflecting device. Okay? Now, remember, the finer your measurement, how do you get the fine measurement? You have to build the equipment to a finer degree of precision. This may mean changes in material. It means you've got to focus your energy source so that you cut a finer edge. It means you have something that you have to have a mirror that's polished to a higher degree so that you don't get imperfections in the mirror that change your measurement. Now, it's those techniques of producing the materials used in the experiment that are also a reflection of the principles you're attempting to discover. So that's called the machine tool principle. So it's not a small thing. They just happen to have a nicer experiment. In some ways, when you build, like you build a tokamak, in building a tokamak, even though it's a relatively primitive fusion approach, you're going to be building machines that are of a degree of refinement, power, containment of flow, et cetera, that means you have to have machines to build them that are superior to anything you had before and are going to require the use of principles that are like the principle you're trying to act on. So without this kind of science, you lose progress in all kinds of production techniques. That's why having lost the space program, aerospace and so forth, you find a stagnation in all kinds of things. Most of our machine tool industry is in the aerospace sector. That's why it's a little bit, you can't just talk about independent machine shops. Or, for example, there's a certain amount of machine tools used in chip production that are significant. Okay, but you have to look at what we've really got. Now, you start to build the right kinds of experiments, and you find that those experiments are the basis for the technological. For example, take the development of solenoids and the development of the telegraph. All this came from the original equipment that they used to run the experiments. Then those experiments became the basis for industrial production of those technologies. So that's how I would look at it. A lot of times, sometimes you're dealing with a real reductionism. It's part of the way these guys talk about things and so on and so forth. But I think in the case of Ampère, he's just using a descriptive approach because he's trying to get at something that hadn't been seen. I mean, you had certain electrical effects. You had the work of people like Franklin in the 18th century. You had some of the other work, some of you have looked at. There was an idea of magnetic orientation related to electrical flows by Oersted and so on and so forth. So this is what Ampère is looking at. Now he's trying to get a sense of what's the geometry. If I hypothesize a flow, which I can think of in some way as elements, where I can take a unit of flow, and then I can chart how this flow goes, and then I want to look at how the changes in the orientation of the related electrical flows and charges are affected by orientation and motion. Then he's setting up the experiments to do that. And this is why people like Weber and Gauss were so interested in this stuff. Remember, part of the solution to the historical problem is Gauss and Weber set up the Magnetischverein. And this involved a big flow of information, knowledge about these kinds of things. Weber actually had the view that in some sense, you could describe, and this goes, in some sense, he wanted to try to describe gravity from the standpoint of electromagnetism, already in the middle of the 19th century. Electrical charges. And he was working on that kind of thing. I mean, this, of course, is in part what Einstein was supposedly working on and so forth. But that gets, you have to really look at that more closely. I don't know. Hello? Yeah.
I've always wondered about when we talk about the nation state as a universal principle, because I have trouble grasping sort of how we conceptualize sort of, social principles as universal principles because of the nature of the way in which individuals and you know, even the human potential changes. This is one of the things about potential relative population idea. You can't kind of, there's no standard metric for people, the one today, people today are different.
No, but you have to take into account, you have to take into account in your principle the increasing living standard. So it's a relative potential population density. It's relative to the living standard and also some of the constraints of geology you might be working with. So, for example, a highly advanced scientific technology in Siberia might produce a lower population density at a high living standard than the same thing in a temperate zone.
Right.
So, but
I was wondering, though, but how, because it seems like, you know, what we think of as the principles that are embodied in the nation state today, you know, 1,000 years from now might look completely different. I mean,
the principle won't look different. The principle, just like the principle wasn't different 1,500 years ago, where you had an approximation of it, or 25, in the Republic. But, because here, look, what the principle isn't the unity of the nation state as such. Okay, the principle is, and these things can be improved upon, but the principle is the principle of physical economy. See, what Lynn does in this idea of a principle, as applied to the nation state, which you do see in a less developed form in Hamilton, or a little bit more developed form in Carey, and in a certain funny way, though not developed in terms of economic theory, you see it in Lincoln. Because what's the point? The point is the same point we're making here. The principle is that the progress of human society depends upon the density of humanity it takes to produce one human being who has at his disposal everything he or she needs to do to be a creative contributor not only to that society but to the future. That's the principle of the nation state. That it exists, its legitimacy, is its ability to create the conditions under which the greatest development of each and every human individual is created, because that's the basis upon which society develops. Now that's the principle of the nation state. Not that we stay together, not that we have food for people as a thing. That's not the principle. That may be a derivative of the principle. The principle is that humanity can only progress if we create an ever-increasing number of human beings with access to all human knowledge and to the ability to act on that human knowledge to create a future for humanity. That's the principle of the nation state. See, where that principle comes in is this point that Lynn keeps bringing, two points that Lynn keeps bringing up, which I know he repeats, and sometimes I think in the repetition things get lost. People just say, oh, he's saying that again. Yeah, he says that every time. Okay, two things. One is that human beings are characterized by nothing but their creative ability to change their circumstances, to grasp a universal principle and to act on it to give us greater power over the universe. That's the defining character. That's the principle upon which we act. Okay? Now, the second point is that up until the nation state, and this is why up until the creation of the American Republic as a principle, that was not the conception of human society. The view is one, see, this is why what you have to get at to see where we are now, because it's still there. The view was that some people were born to either be slaves, owned by other people for the purposes of supporting them. And these people, it was not good for them to develop, because then they would want and need things that could not be and should not be produced. Some people may not be slaves, they may be serfs or servants. Others may go out on their own, and they can do that as long as they can, but if they get in the way, some of them have to be reduced. This is what Bertrand Russell talks about. We cannot support human civilization at an ever-progressing level of knowledge and living standard. So the principle of the nation state, as it was introduced, as we've discussed it, it was discussed by people like Dante, discussed by Cusa, but it was implemented only in the United States as a principle. If you look at Lincoln, he adhered to the principle. If you look at FDR, he adhered to the principle. Others were an approximation of it. Many times we didn't have that leadership. But that principle of human relationship, even if we may develop it in some other forms, that principle will not go away. That was a principle that was discovered, in Western civilization at least, by, in some ways, Solon, Socrates, and Plato, but it didn't become an operative principle until the American Revolution. So that's not going to change. But it's a principle of how humanity develops, how it exists. It's not. It's beyond an economic principle. Yeah, one thing occurs to me. It's a funny thing. This may not appeal to all of you, but I can say a lot of times I'm not the warmest person in the world. In other words, I'm not a person who overwhelms you with the sense of I just love everybody and everybody's wonderful and so on and so forth. Now, on the other hand, I know that that's the way humanity is. I know that what we need is to be able to look at every human being from the standpoint of their powers of development. That's knowledge. I know that. Now, I think, and this is that's a better place to be, because I don't want to depend on somebody else's feelings. They can be ephemeral. Some people walk in, they're warm, they like everybody, and then they're in a bad mood. And all of a sudden, they don't seem to like everybody anymore. I would rather not be susceptible to the arbitrary whims of feeling states. I want to impose as an authoritarian principle, you have to like everybody. It's a physical law of the universe. If you don't, you're in violation of the universe. Petty dislikes that throw you into a state where you can't act for humanity because you're just sick and tired of people and this guy treated you so badly. That's a violation of the laws of the universe. That's why people don't like authoritarian principles. So how can you force me to like everybody? Well, I can't force you to like everybody, but I can force you to recognize the principle that if you don't, there's something wrong with you. Like is a funny word, but you may not like people, but you have to act for them anyway. So it's a principle. It's a social principle. Yeah, it's about time to break it up. All right, so we have lunch from 11:30 to 12:30. Lainey, you want to make an announcement? Oh.